Here were my instructions from Mike. You let me know if I'm correct. He said you were finishing up week 8 continued. So that's in Colossians 4, 2 through 6. We're looking at verses 5 and 6, he said. And then he said he handed out the last one, week 9, that's 7 through 18 last week. Is that correct? Look on Carol's face says she's not sure. And I have... Oh, okay, and I have some more if you don't... Do you need these? Those? Anybody else? You need one? You can make another copy if you need. I used one today, so... Okie doke. Unload my pockets here. Gotta get as cool as I can because it's hot. Can I take my shoes off? Is that okay? Yeah. Okay, all right. I just want to make sure. So let's do this. Let me read. Let's read 5 through 18. Here's the plan for tonight. We're going to finish up 5 and 6, which there's not much there to go through question-wise. And then we're going to get as far into 7 through 18 as we can, and we'll finish up Colossians next week. And then the week after, right? Yes? The week after, James will be here. And Mike said you can do whatever you want. So who knows? I have no idea what he's going to do. And then could be exciting. I don't know. And then the week after that, Mike will be back and we'll start Philemon. Bueno? So let me read this. Starting in verse 5 of Colossians 4. Walk in wisdom toward outsiders, making the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Tychicus will tell you all about my activities. He is a beloved brother and faithful minister and fellow servant in the Lord. I have sent him to you for this very purpose, that you may know how we are, and that he may be, and that he may encourage your hearts, and with him Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of you. They will tell you of everything that's taken place here. Aristarchus, my fellow prisoner, greets you, and Mark, the cousin of Barnabas, concerning whom you've received instructions. If he comes to you, welcome him. And Jesus, who is called Justice, these are the only men of the circumcision among my fellow workers for the kingdom of God, and they have been a comfort to me. Epaphras, who is one of you, a servant of Christ Jesus, greets you, always struggling on your behalf in his prayers, that you may stand mature and fully assured in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has worked hard for you and for those in Laodicea and in Hierapolis. Luke, the beloved physician, greets you, as does Demas. Give my greetings to the brothers at Laodicea and to Nympha and the church in her house. And when this letter has been read among you, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans, and see that you also read the letter from Laodicea. And say to Archippus, see that you fulfill the ministry that you have received in the Lord. I, Paul, write this greeting with my own hand. Remember my chains. Grace be with you. All right. So let's look at 5 through 7. Hey, Nick. Were you here last week? Did you? Okay. No, I handed out some notes, but I ran out of them. So remind me after we get done and I can make some copies for you. Unless someone wants to run back and make copies right now. It doesn't matter to me. Sounds good. All right. So, on page 3 of 2 through 6, starts off saying, while the Colossians are to be wary of the false teachers among them, Paul does not mean that they should disengage from relationship with the citizens of Colossae who are unfamiliar with the Christian faith. Indeed, Paul's instruction encourages wise and winsome witness that commends the faith to outsiders. So, it's a good question here. It's a simple one, but it's a good one. How do we know that in these verses Paul is referring to our evangelistic witness? Looking at 5 and 6, how do we know that these verses Paul's referring to, how do we know that in these verses Paul's referring to our evangelistic witness? And I did leave my water up here. All right. You see any key phrases in there that would say, oh, he's talking about our evangelistic witness or anything like that? Yeah, outsiders. You said time? Oh, okay. Or I thought you said tidings or something like that. Walking, which implies what? Sure, and I think we get to that too, but yes. Anything else? Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other word I had was the word answer. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Which assumes something, doesn't it? Well, it assumes a number of things. But speaking of evangelistic witness here, what is Paul assuming about us as believers if we are having a toward outsider's life and a platform where we're answering each person? What's he assuming of us? Absolutely, that we're not hiding in a closet or something like that. That we're not just in our rooms with the doors locked. Paul just assumes. He's telling them how to conduct themselves, but he's assuming that they're actually out conducting themselves. So let's look at these 5 points here. Yeah. The next point, he says, in these two verses, Paul highlights 5 issues that are important to our witness. What does he mean by each of the following 5 issues, and how do we carry them out? So the first one, he says, walk in wisdom toward outsiders. Seth, what did you say about walk? Yeah. Right. How we are conducting ourselves, right? What else does walking imply? In other words, what would be the opposite of walking? I guess there's two opposites, maybe. What'd you say? Sitting is one, sure, which would mean the opposite of what Paul was assuming of us, right? That we're actually out among outsiders, as he calls it. What's the other opposite of walking? Running, right? I guess walking would be somewhere in the middle. One's right wing and one's left wing. I don't know what's what, but walking's the centrist one, I guess. I don't know why that got political. Sorry. But flesh that out for a minute. He says it's the way you're conducting your life, but now fit in those two extremes of sitting and running. What does walking imply in the middle? Hi, James. Sure. So I'm thinking in terms of what happened. Yeah, there you go. That's what I'm going for. Because what happens if you run? Well, at least what happens to me when I run? You get tired pretty quickly too, especially if you've only been sitting, right? I've only been sitting and now I'm running and now I'm tired. So walking implies just kind of a steady, consistent way of conducting yourself. That this is how you're conducting yourself. And it's also a consistent thing. Because if you're a sprinter or something, no one at least a normal person sprints a marathon. You get those people that get like the 3-minute miles and they're finishing marathons in 2 hours, and there's like a very small group of people in the world that can do that. But most people can't sprint for 2 hours. That's crazy, right? Like the Tour de France is going on right now. Insane. Like riding a bike 100 miles a day for 21 days. Most people can't do that, right? So walking is something that people can do for a long time. It's just how you're conducting yourself in a steady thing. So look, what does he say? He starts off saying walk, but he gives us a description of what a walk is to look like. So what does it mean to walk in wisdom toward outsiders? So there's a thoughtfulness to it. You're thinking about what you're doing. Think about wisdom in terms of, we've been in Proverbs before. What is wisdom in Proverbs? The fear of the Lord, right? And that's how the Bible would use the word wisdom throughout. I mean, Proverbs gives us the best definition of it. So put that forward. Put the biblical definition of the word wisdom forward into this phrase of walking in wisdom, and specifically toward outsiders. He's not saying don't walk in wisdom toward believers, but he's specifically pointing to walk in wisdom toward outsiders. What does that look like in that fully fleshed out sentence that we're making? Sure. Good. Before I move on, before I say anything else, if there's something I need to repeat, let me know. That's what I'm trying to say, but I'm not doing it. If I can't even say what I need to say, I don't know if I can say what someone else said. Is the nodding you need to? So say that again so that I can. It's a preparation for knowing how to interact with unbelievers who don't know what believers know. Is that what you said? Yeah, I think so. And in fact, I think you are already moving where Paul moves in kind of the last part of those five issues that he comes to. That there's a specific way that we're to interact with unbelievers. He says, let your speech be gracious, let it be seasoned with salt. So you're right, we'll get there. We said walking is conducting oneself continually, right? Wisdom, the fear of the Lord. So conducting yourself in a manner that is consistent with one who fears the Lord toward outsiders, right? I think that would be the sentence. That's what we were constructing. And you went ahead and said what it looks like toward outsiders, which is what he goes forward into. Did anyone have like a pithy sentence that they wrote down that they want? It was so good that they're thinking about stenciling on their wall or something that they want to share. No, that's okay. I told Seth earlier, by the way, that I have kind of a twisted dark sense of humor when it comes to like awkward silence. So if I ask a question and nobody answers, like the longer it goes without anybody answering, the more I enjoy it for some reason. So just know that it's probably better to just answer a question just so that I'm not getting any weird type of satisfaction from it or something. So anyway, let's move on to the next one before that gets weird. Making the best use of the time. What does that mean? What's Paul talking about there? Making the best use of the time. there's something wrong with that? No, I was just asking. I didn't know. I was just asking. No, that's good. Being thoughtful about what you're doing, sure. Did anyone happen to look up, those of you that tended to be overachievers in school, did you happen to look up in your Strong's Concordance or anything what any of these words mean? Okay, no, that's okay. So making the best use is an interesting phrase. I looked it up, and I'm not saying I was the overachiever. I just needed to know what it was since I'm up here. Making the best use, it's like an investing term. And so it has to do with a person who sees a business opportunity, or there's a bunch of business opportunities out there in front of him, and he is investing in the one that he thinks will return the most value. He's not just throwing his money out there, but he wants to invest in the one that he'll see returns on. So the word is buying up, which means skillfully investing. And so if you think about that in terms of evangelistic witness or whatever, he says making the best use of the time. I mean, I think you can broaden it out, not just to evangelistic witness, but what are you doing in your life that is worth something, right? Take stock of your life and say, this is a pointless venture that I'm involved in, or this makes a lot of sense. I need to focus time on this. Now put it in regards to what he's talking about here. And he's saying, I think, look, make sure you're conducting your life wisely, first of all. And if you're not, take stock of that and realize that you're not conducting yourself wisely. Know that outsiders are looking at you, and make sure that you are making the best use of your time, because God's glory is at stake, right? Like these two verses seem like they're just two small little verses, but there's a lot in here, aren't there? I also wrote down on alert for opportunity, which I think is part of it. I don't know if... Well, let's ask this. When a van pulls up in your neighborhood and a bunch of people get out with books and you see them going door to door, you know what I'm talking about. Do the shutters draw and you go and you hide under your bed until the doorbell rings and you wait 5 minutes and you go and see if the coast is clear? Or are you looking for an opportunity to talk to somebody? I'm not saying one is right or wrong. I'm just asking here, what does it look like to be on alert for an opportunity to talk with someone about the gospel? I think that's what he's talking about. You know, if you're at work, and I used to do this in the warehouse because there would be two of us, an 8-hour shift, 5 days a week, so we got a lot of talking time. A lot of it was useless talking, right? Video games and stuff, if you want to be honest. But there's plenty of opportunity where someone says, man, I had a rough day. You go, what are you going to do right there? Believer who's walking in wisdom toward outsiders and making the best use of the time, what are you going to do right there? Where someone who you've spent the past 600 hours of work time with says, I had a rough day. What are you going to do with that? This is being on alert for opportunity. What about the next one? Let your speech always be gracious. Not chewing them out. Yeah, why are you not a believer? Get over here so I can beat you up. That happens, doesn't it? Where was I? I was in Concord the other day, I think. And there's a guy on the side of the road. It said, like, Jesus saves, honk, if you believe that or something like that. What's that? He's an old guy. But it was just like, people were going by and he's yelling at him, Jesus loves you! And they're like, I mean, it's true. And I'm not saying it's not working, but, you know, like, it's not, maybe, you know, he's speaking at least. But is it gracious speech? I don't know. I mean, it's something to think about. But What is the content of gracious speech? What do you think the content of gracious speech is? Gentleness? Sure. Tone? Yeah, what are we talking about? Yeah, we're talking about the gospel, right? So you want to have gracious speech towards somebody. Well, fundamentally, what is the most gracious thing that they can hear? You're on your way to hell, but there's a solution. His name's Jesus, right? Gracious. But how? See, the content is there, the gospel, but how is the important part? Let your speech be gracious. Right? If you come in with the sledgehammer, and you say like, everybody needs to believe in Jesus or bad things are going to happen. Like I'm going to get hit with a sledgehammer, right? Because you're swinging a sledgehammer at me. That's not gracious speech. So patience, tone, all sorts of stuff like that. But look at the next thing he says. He says, let your speech always be gracious. But then there's this phrase right here. I don't want us to talk about this phrase. What do you think it means to be seasoned with salt? What do you think it means for your speech to be seasoned with salt in relationship to your evangelical witness? So you said the Beatitudes being the salt of the earth, and it's something that's preserving. And you said, so that might look like an example, something gracious, how you can show others how you deal with certain situation. Did I capture that well enough? Okay. And did you hear that back there? Okay. Yeah, I think you're on the right track there with the preserving nature of it, and that we're to be the salt of the earth, and that there's something to it that is attractive, right? You said you're able to give an example of something. Yeah? And what's that? Do it with love? Sure. Because everyone knows when you're putting more salt on the food, you're cooking with love, right? If you're holding the salt back, you don't love the people you're cooking for, right? That's true. It's true. It's true. It doesn't taste good if it's not cooked with love. That's absolutely true. It tastes bland, right? So salt adds flavor. Salt preserves. What do you think that means as far as our speech with unbelievers? Mm-hmm. Okay, think about this. You're eating. Nick, where do you like to eat? Just name somewhere. Chipotle. You have to use Chipotle? That's fine. Okay, so you go to Chipotle. What? Yeah, it's true. There's a lot of sodium in Chipotle. So you go to Chipotle, and you leave with the flavor of Chipotle in your mouth, right? And you get home and you go, man, I'm full. Maybe you're thinking I'm never going to eat there again. But then it's like 2 a.m. and you're laying in your bed. And what are you thinking? You're thinking, man, I want some Chipotle. Maybe it's the sodium. I don't know. But it's the flavor, isn't it? It's the flavor of the Chipotle that you're going for. Like La Costa, right? You're sitting there in your bed and you're going, I want a super wet burrito, carne asada, red sauce. Telling you, right? That's what it is. It's the flavor. So what does that mean as far as our speech with unbelievers? We're talking to them about the gospel and we're being gracious in our speech. And we're skillfully investing our time in them. We're walking in wisdom toward them. And then it's seasoned with salt. What are we saying? Yeah, it's tasty, right? Because we're telling them something that we believe to be true, first of all, right? Like, we're not saying, you know, if you eat this bland thing, you're going to love it, man. Right? Not true. Saying, like, okay, take this for example. I know that Nick likes Chipotle. How do I know Nick likes Chipotle? Because Nick talks about Chipotle, right? And why does he talk about Chipotle? Because he likes it, right? So that's what he's talking about. He's talking about his regard to the gospel. It's like you're having a conversation with somebody and they like you're in the warehouse and the guy says, man, I had a rough day. What are you going to go to? You could say, look, man, Chipotle makes me feel better. Right? Hopefully that's not the answer. Right? What are you going to say? Like, listen to this. I've got the best news in the world. And you're telling it to them. And they leave the conversation saying, man, I want more of that. That seems good. That tasted good. Right? I was reading. There's a pastor in Flagstaff, Arizona. In fact, I forget the name of the church. Flagstaff something. His name's Stephen Cole. He's a pastor. And he's got like 1,300 sermons, and they're all in PDFs on his website. And it's a fantastic resource if you're ever... He's preached most everything in the New Testament. So if you need to look something up, he's a good guy to look up. I look him up all the time to see how he's commented on things. But I looked on this verse... And he said, seasoned with salt, not salty speech like a sailor. Like, yeah, okay, that's true. Our presentation of the gospel should have people leave being hungry for more. I think that's what that means. And then the last thing, what do you think this means? So that you may know how you ought to answer each person. Let's go back to the beginning of it. Let your speech, because we've broken the sentence up so much, we don't know what the sentence is talking about anymore. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt, for this purpose, so that you may know how you ought to answer each person. What's that? Yeah. You're able to spend the time with them. I think Lily got it. I think she was on the right track. What did you say? You'd said patience, but you said something before that. When we were talking about walking and understanding who you're talking to, right? Yeah. There's a sensitivity to the person because you're invested in them at this point. You know what they need. You know what they're feeling. You've spoken graciously with them. You haven't attacked them. You've told them the best news in the world that you think's the tastiest thing in the world. Now you're speaking with this person, and now you know how you ought to answer each person. It doesn't mean that you have all the answers necessarily to every issue they're going to bring up, right? Because you get in a conversation with someone, and someone says, well, what do you think about Ezekiel 45:6? You go, what? You know, I'm not saying you know the answer to every single question that I don't even know if that's a verse. I think it is, but you know how you ought to answer each person. Someone comes in a rage and you go, gentle. You can be gentle with this person. Someone's upset. You don't jump on them, right? You're sensitive. You're gracious. You're speaking the content of the gospel here. You're walking in wisdom. You're bathing all of this in the word. And what were the previous verses talking about? I know we didn't go over them. I didn't read over them. But what have you guys spent the past couple of weeks talking about? Assuming you've been here talking about this stuff for the past couple of weeks. Yeah, what does verse 2 say? What's the beginning of verse 2? There's your answer. Yeah. Right, all of this is bathed in prayer. You're not going into this just blindly without the creator of the universe on your side. Is that the end of those notes? That is the end of those notes. Okay, any questions about that? I don't want to skip ahead here without... I think so. Absolutely. And it's going to look different from person to person, and it's going to look different from conversation to conversation with the same person, maybe even in a matter of minutes, right? So he's not just saying, here's the steps. You say step one, and then you go through this, and step two, and you go through this, and step three, because you can't do that, right? He says this is how you should be conducting yourself. This is how you should be thinking about your speech. This is what it should be like. And now when someone comes to you with an answer, you answer them because you are a wise person. Because you have not only been continuing steadfastly in prayer, but you're bathed in the word here. And fundamentally, the gospel is the thing in front of you that you love dearly that you want to share with people. And so you're going to get that across to them in whatever way they need to hear it, I think. Yeah. It's an individual thing. Each and every one. And I don't think he's just saying, you know, I don't think verse 5 and 6 should only be applied to like unbelievers. I think Paul would tell us all in the church, walk in wisdom toward one another, right? Make the best use of the time. Let your speech always be gracious, seasoned with salt. That's just how we should be. But specifically toward outsiders, toward unbelievers, we don't cloister, right? We don't huddle into a place and never interact with unbelievers. But we are the church, right? So this building isn't the church. We are the church, and we go places during the week, and we live in the world as believers, seasoned with salt, gracious in our speech, sharing the gospel, and then we come back together and worship. I think that's what he's talking about. Anything else? All right. Well, let's move on to week 9, the letter's conclusion, greetings, and final instructions. Would it be helpful for me to read this page? What time is it? We got about 20 minutes. I'm going to take the blank stares as a resounding yes. That's what I'm going to do. Okay, so 7 through 18, and we'll see how far we get here. In Colossians 4, 7 through 18, Paul concludes his letter. He passes on greetings from his 6 co-workers and provides final instructions to ensure that the Colossian and Laodicean churches will remain steadfast in the faith. The closing can be divided into 5 parts: a reference to the men carrying the letter, verses 7 through 9, a series of greetings, 10 through 15, a request for an exchange of letters between the Colossian and Laodicean churches, verse 16, and an exhortation to Archippus regarding his ministry, verse 17, and a final signature with a brief prayer request and grace wish, verse 18. And this quote, Christopher Beetham, he's the guy that wrote the study guide, right, that we're using, I think. This was his quote. Whoever this guy is, this is his quote. Although Paul is justly renowned for his apostolic ministry, meaning renowned for being an apostle, including the 13 letters in the New Testament that are attributed to him, Paul could never have accomplished the ministry he did without help. The text for this week is just 12 short verses, yet it mentions no fewer than 8 colleagues, 10 if Nympha and Archippus are included. These colleagues serve as letter couriers, delegates, church planters, pastors, and a host of house churches. They were also faithful friends and prayer partners. The church must never forget that gospel ministry is always a team effort. So one, Tychicus, letter carrier and apostolic representative with Onesimus, verses 7 through 9. With no postal service available, Paul sent Tychicus to deliver and present the letter. Tychicus probably also carried the letter to the Ephesians and to Philemon. The Ephesians 6, 21 through 22. Tychicus had been a faithful colleague for some time. Acts 20, verse 4. And then compare Titus 3:12 and 2 Timothy 4:12. He would read the letter aloud to the assembled house church, filling out its instruction as questions arose. So he would get up in front and he would read the letter and someone would go, "What on earth does that word mean?" And then he would flesh it out and continue reading. That's what he's saying. So with what three titles of honor does Paul refer to Tychicus, which is a super cool name, in verse 7? Why do you think he described him in this way? So what are the three titles of honor that Paul uses of Tychicus in verse 7? Beloved brother, faithful minister, and fellow servant in the Lord. Yes. Why do you think he described him in this way? Yeah, I don't know, because he was. It doesn't have to be profound or anything. Sure, he probably wasn't just attributing this to anybody, right? Just, hey, that guy, saw that guy walking down the street with it. He's a beloved brother, a faithful minister, and a fellow servant in the Lord. Yeah, he probably knew him. He knew him well. He knew his character. What were you going to say? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a very good answer. Look, I'm Paul. I know I've got the big name. I know I'm the dude that the whole book of Acts was written about, you know. But listen, this guy Tychicus, there's no way that I could do any of this if it hadn't been for this guy. Right? I think that's a major thing. You think people have a big name now, right? Like who's some big names in the churches? Like you think maybe John Piper every now and then struggles with an ego? Which I don't know, but I would assume every now and then you would think, those thoughts would sneak in. In fact, wasn't it 5 or 6 years ago that he took a year off just to make sure that he wasn't? And that says a lot, doesn't it? John MacArthur, he's a big name. Whole bunch of big names. What about Paul? Right? Oh, yeah. I wrote 13 books of the New Testament. Right? I used to think the introductions to his letters and the outros, if you will, the ends of the book were just kind of pointlessness. It was just like, well, he has to say hi somehow, and he has to say bye because it's a letter. So that there's nothing really of value in those. But that's not true at all, is it? I mean, this is big. For Paul to say he's not only a beloved brother, he's a faithful minister and a fellow servant in the Lord. It says something about his character. It says something about Paul's character too, I think, doesn't it? And it also is Paul saying, this is not about me, and there's no way I could do any of this by myself. I wasn't called to do any of this by myself, and I wouldn't be able to do any of this by myself. Back. In verse 8, what explicit reasons does Paul give for sending Tychicus? And then you can compare with Paul's concern in chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. So that he may know how, so that, sorry, I'm going to try this again. That you may know how we are, and that he may encourage your hearts. Look at chapter 2. This is Paul's concern. He says, "For I want you to know how great a struggle I have for you." And that word struggle means like a really difficult laboring. It's not just like a, it's sort of a difficult time, but it's like the picture of like major burden. "I want you to know how great a struggle I have, Paul, for you, the Colossian church, and for those at Laodicea, and for all who have not seen me face to face, that their hearts may be encouraged, being knit together in love to reach all the riches of full assurance of understanding and the knowledge of God's mystery, which is Christ." So look what he's doing in sending Tychicus. I mean, he says, "So that you can know how we are and to encourage your hearts." But why? Why would Paul want to do that? Why would Paul want people to know how he is? So that the people can understand the labor of love that Paul and his companions are going through. Yes, I think so. Yes, he's the apostles of the Gentiles, so he's all over the place. Right. So he's calling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, think about here, for example, when there's a missionary that we have. And they come and they give their update on what they're doing. What are they doing when they're giving an update? Like, they're giving a sales pitch. Is that what it is? Like, here's what we've been about. And if you'd like to join in for $9.99 a month, you'll get the free package. And for next, is that what they're, what are they doing when they come to give an update? They're coming to encourage their hearts. And I think also they're saying, but well, let me not answer the question. Let me ask the question. What's involved in the encouragement of their hearts? What are they encouraging them with? Like, what are missionaries doing when they come and they're encouraging us? What are they telling us? Yeah, God's working, right? Yeah, God's working. The gospel is going out. Right? Because we can get so just, I don't know, is Brentwooded a term? Do you know what I'm trying to say when I say Brentwooded? We just get so just isolated and localized here, and the only thing that's happening in the world happens in 94513 and occasionally in Oakley, right? Like, that's how we think. And you get, well, like Venencio coming literally across rivers and over mountains and boats and planes and trains and cars, and he comes here and he says, "God is saving thousands of people because of you guys sending a couple of dollars a month to be able to support us." I mean, when you go, oh, wow, there's actually stuff going on in the world. So not only is he doing that, but I think the church here also loves Paul, don't they? And so it's not like, we also want to know how our missionaries are doing just because we we love them also. And so there's both things going on. We want to know how they are, and they want to let us know what God's doing in the world. So there you go. And then let's end with, it's only 6:52. We might be able to get through. No, let's end with this question. There's no way we can get through another thing. Verse 9, Paul mentions Onesimus. Quick, very important point. You guys seen the movie, That Thing You Do? Yeah, no? That Thing You Do? It's about a band. They wanted to be, the band wants to be the Wonders. But you know how the Beatles, they changed up the letters so it was B-E-A, like beat, like they were on beat, Beatles music band, rather than B-E-E-T. The Wonders wanted to be the Wonders, O-N-E, because they were like number one or something. But then everybody thought their name was the O-Neaters. So whenever I read the word Onesimus, I always think the Onesimus because of that. And that, like I said, it doesn't matter in anything, but I thought you could share in my agony every time you read the word. Yeah, she'd like that. So anyway, verse 9, Paul mentions Onesimus, who's a runaway slave. And by the way, essentially the content of Philemon, where you guys will be going next, is about this guy Onesimus and his master Philemon. So Paul mentions Onesimus, a runaway slave who's become a Christian. So he ran away and he became a Christian after he ran away. Paul's companion letter to Philemon is concerned with the relationship between Onesimus and his legal master, Philemon. How might Paul's description of Onesimus prepare the way for a sympathetic reception by Philemon of Paul's letter? Because Paul sends the letter of Philemon to Philemon, and he says, I'm sending Onesimus back to you. And he says, this is how I would like you to respond to this. In fact, at one point he says, as an apostle, I could command you to do something, but I'm not going to do that. Right? Like, have you ever done that? Like, as your father, I could make you do something, but I know you're just going to do the right thing. Like, that's how Paul writes the letter of Philemon. And so he's sending Onesimus back. What does it say about Onesimus in verse 9? And with him, Onesimus, our faithful and beloved brother, who is one of you, as they will tell you of everything that's taken place here. So how does Paul's description of Onesimus prepare the way for a sympathetic reception by Philemon of this letter that he's about to get? Well, yeah, look how he describes Onesimus. What does he use to describe Onesimus? Yeah, faithful and not just beloved. What type of beloved brother and one of you? The church that Philemon's a part of. I don't know anything about Philemon, the guy. If you find out you're getting a letter from Paul and it's coming back with a slave that ran away and you found out he's a Christian, and I just imagine you're nervous, at the very least, don't you think? And I mean, think about this scene here. The Colossian church, Tychicus shows up and he's holding two letters, right? And he's got one and he says, this one's for the church. He stands up and he reads it. And he said, all right, in conclusion, with him, Onesimus, who happens to be sitting on the front row right now, our faithful, I don't know how big the church is, but I imagine it's a decent sized church. Our faithful brother, our faithful and beloved brother. Everyone in the church knows Onesimus and knows that he ran away Philemon, right? Philemon probably was upset. He's one of you. He's saying this in front of the church. They're going to tell you of everything that's taken place here. I mean, just think about that. And then Tychicus says, by the way, Philemon, I've got a letter for you too. Of course, it would be read to the church. that's frightening, I think, right? I would be a little nervous myself. So how do you think it prepared the way for a sympathetic reception? I mean, What do you think Paul, or what do you think Philemon is thinking? Not only Philemon, but the whole church is involved here, right? I mean, Paul doesn't want factions forming. Paul doesn't want this or that forming. How do you think this prepares a sympathetic reception by Philemon of Paul's letter? Yeah, this is a big deal, right? There's something big going on here. And not only that, but think about the terms that he uses here. What do you think the relation, he's going to get into it in Philemon, in the letter of Philemon, but what do you think Philemon is getting from this over the relationship between Paul and this guy? What do you think Philemon is hearing in this letter right here, Colossians, about the relationship between Paul and Onesimus? Yeah. He's beloved. He's my brother. Not like Paul just caught him and put him in a cage and sent him back. I mean, in Philemon, he says he was a helpful servant for me and we became close friends and all this stuff. Look, he's faithful. Think about that word faithful of a servant who had just run away. What's gone on in Onesimus's life that he would run away from a master, get saved, sent back and called faithful now? What does the word faithful mean? Not running away, right? Yeah. This isn't a guy that runs away anymore. He's a guy that stays true. I love him. He's my brother. He's one of you. He's your brother too. I imagine Philemon's thinking, I've got some serious thinking to do here, right? All right, we'll end there. Here's what we'll do next week. Finish up. So greetings from Paul and his co-workers, instructions regarding a letter exchange, instructions for Archippus, and then Paul's personal authentication of the letter and final blessing.